Thank you for coming alive. It's high time. Okay. So I want to pick up in volume 15, June the 21st, 1923. And I have a VIP on this one. I was doing my usual adoration to my crucified good, and I was saying to him, I enter into your will, or rather, give me your hand and place me in the immensity of your will yourself. Now, we're inclined to just say, I fuse in your holy will. But look at the way Louisa says, look, give me your hand and you put me there yourself. Okay, that is to make absolutely certain that this fusing actually happens. Okay, that I may do nothing which is not the effect of your most holy will. Now, while I was saying this, I thought to myself, how is this? The divine will is everywhere. I'm already in it. And yet I say, I enter into your will. This is important now because it answers the question as to why you have to keep doing it. Is that okay? Because I've had lots of questions with people saying to me, but if I do the prevenient act in the morning, surely that's enough for the day. Well, Jesus says it isn't. Watch this. Now, he's talking to Louisa, who's at the highest level of union with God that I've ever come across in any saint. Okay. So, Louisa said, how is this? The divine will is everywhere. I'm already in it. And yet I say, I enter into your will. But while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus moving in my interior told me, my daughter, yet there is a great difference between one who prays and acts because my will envelops her. Would you ever colour that? Being everywhere by its own nature. And one who, of her own will, having the knowledge of what she does within herself, enters into the divine sphere of my will to operate and pray. So over and above the fact that the divine will is in everything and is everywhere, is that we actually specifically ask at a particular moment that the divine will would actually take over and help us to pray at that level. Because we know from our experience that you may actually fuse at one particular moment and then a couple of hours later discover you haven't even remembered. So we do actually slip in and out. Okay. So he's saying it's actually important. So do you know what happens, he says? It happens as when the sun fills the earth with its light, though the light and the heat are not the same at all points, as we know. So some countries it's hotter and other countries it's cooler. At some points there is shade and at other points there is direct light and the heat is more intense. Now, who enjoys more light? Who feels more heat? One who is in the shade or one who at those points where the light is not covered with the shade? However, one cannot say that where there is shade, there is no light. It's very interesting. The light is there. But the intensity of the light depends on your decision to go out into the sun or to come in and sit down or to go into the shade. That's your decision. And he's saying it's our decision to actually let the divine will take over at a particular moment. Although where there is no shade, the light is more vivid, of course, and the heat is more intense. Even more, the rays of the sun seems to invest and absorb the creature. And if the sun had reason and was able to think, and one creature exposed herself of her own will to its burning rays, and in the name of all said to it, thank you, sun, for your light and for all the goods that you produce by filling the earth. For all, I want to give you the return of the good that you do. What glory, honour and satisfaction would the sun not receive? So the importance of us actually in the name of all, fusing in the divine will and deliberately spreading that light and grace and beauty and glory everywhere. Now, it's true that my will is everywhere. That's Psalm 139. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your face? If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I go into the depths of Sheol, you are there. And darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. So since my will is everywhere, but the shade of the human will does not allow the soul to feel the vividness of the light. Now, I love that, the shade of the human will. This is, we are so used to operating on a much lower level of our own will. And he says the shade of that doesn't allow you to experience the intensity of God's presence and all the good that it contains. On the other hand, I love this, on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's very Jewish. On the other hand, by wanting to enter into my will, the soul lays down her own will. So in deliberately fusing, we are deliberately putting aside our own will. And she removes the shade of her own volition, and my will makes its vivid light shine. Now, it's when he gives you the comparison with the sun and the shade that what he's actually saying is much more clear. So at that point, the divine will invests her, it transforms her into light itself. Now, we're only at volume 15. And as we go on into the higher volumes, the process is that we have to be spiritualized, or the other language is divinized. And the church has taught us that from the beginning, that the second person of the Blessed Trinity became man or humanized in order to divinize us. OK, so that's the process that he's doing. But in these writings, that spiritualization or divinization is also called being transformed into light, because God is light. It also speaks about us being transformed into love, because God is love. So God is love, God is light. So we have to be transformed into him. So when the moment of death comes, this tiny little spark goes into the fire. This tiny little light goes into the great light. This tiny little spark of love goes into the furnace of love. And someone who's operating this way in the divine will, that movement is direct. It doesn't have to be down below to try and get some preparation done. Is that okay? And the soul plunged into my eternal volition says to me, thank you, O Holy Supreme Volition, for your light and for all the goods that you produce by filling heaven and earth with your eternal will. For all, I want to give you the return of the good that you do. This is us saying, I love you, I adore you, I praise you, I bless you, I thank you for everybody. And I feel such honor, glory and satisfaction that no other equals it. Now, why does no other equal it? It's simply that you're doing it on the level of the divine will. And the reason why the saints of the latter days will be greater than the saints of the former days is just very simply that we will be operating in the divine will and the others were operating from the human will. It's actually very simple. It doesn't mean that we were more heroic in certain actions or anything. So we're operating on a different level. That's like saying the first airplanes that they flew in the skies, the pilots were very, very brave. Okay, because they were flying bits of things that they hardly knew how it worked. And then they improved the airplanes and it was so much better to fly. But now when you fly in a 747, the comparison between that and the guys who managed to get themselves off the ground, there's just no comparison. But it's still flying. How do you get it? So all the saints that have come up all during the history of the church at various stages, they all had their own heroisms. But there's no comparison with operating in the divine level. Is that okay? So, my daughter, how many evils the shade of one's will does. Uh-oh, this needs to be coloured. It cools the soul down. That really needs to be coloured. The more we operate out of our own will, it just cools the souls down. It produces sloth. That means you're not moving spiritually. You know the sloth doesn't like moving. It produces sleep. That means you are not living an active life, and sluggishness. Now, they're all aspects of the same thing, sloth, sleep and sluggishness. That means you're going nowhere fast. the opposite for one who lives in the divine will. Okay. So after this, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself, and I saw as if contagious diseases were to come. So this is your Amos 3:7 again, and Isaiah 64:10. The Lord never does anything without showing the prophets first. I saw as if contagious diseases were to come, and many people were carried to leper hospitals. Now, this is 1923. The only language Louisa has is a leper hospital. We would call it an isolation unit. Now, who were the people who were put into isolation units? They were TB patients. Okay, and TB was very strong at this early part of the 20th century. So that's why she calls them leper hospitals. She means isolation hospitals. A general fright was reigning, and many other maladies of new kinds were turning up. Okay, but I hope that Jesus may want to placate himself by his merits, by the merits of his most holy, precious blood, she said. So she's seeing that one of the great chastisements is contagious diseases. We still have them. Ebola is a terrible one today, because while they can control it somehow, they can't really. Okay. So I want to go on to June the 28th, 1923. So how in creating man, God cast into him the seed of his eternal love. I think this is fantastic. I was thinking of the immense love of my sweet Jesus, Louise. Please turn off your mobile phones. I was thinking of the immense love of my most sweet Jesus, and he let me see all souls as though bound inside a net of love. And he said to me, my daughter, in creating man, I cast into him many seeds of love. If God didn't give us this love, we wouldn't have it. We wouldn't have any ability to love anybody. He said, seeds of love are in his intelligence, in his eyes, in his word, in his heart, in his hands, in his feet, in everything I placed a seed of love. Now look at all the expressions of love that need to come out of us through the use of our minds, our intelligence, through our eyes. You can look at someone with love, can't you? You can look at someone with contempt as well. Through your heart, your word, your hands, your and so on. And I was to work it from the outside. And together with me, I placed all created things in order to make this seed sprout and to grow according to my will. So the book of Genesis tells us in chapter 2 that man was put into a garden of Eden, a garden of paradise. In other words, the creation that God made for us, and he tells us it was specifically made for us, was to enable us to be able to grow. You put a person into circumstances to enable them to grow. We put children into schools hoping they will grow. They're supposed to grow intellectually in every other way. Notice I said supposed to now that there's dreadful things happening. So he put man into the earth with all the correct circumstances for him to grow to his fullness. So having been placed by an eternal God, this seed was also eternal. Now, where he's going to with this is the only baggage allowed on our return flight to heaven is love. No other baggage is allowed. All other baggage is prohibited. And the only thing that will get you into heaven is love. So if somebody dies with practically no love in their hearts, they have to gain something in purgatory. Otherwise, there's no entry into heaven. Because nothing outside of God can go into heaven. Nothing. And God is love and God is light. So if there's darkness in us, the darkness has to be dealt with. If there's any absence of love, that has to be dealt with as well. So man contains an eternal love within himself. Okay, so beside that you can put John 13:34-35, where Jesus said, you are to love one another in the same way as I loved you. Okay, And you can also put John 15:9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you, so you are to love one another. You are to love one another, therefore, at a divine level, because this is an eternal love. So man contains an eternal love within himself, and an eternal love goes towards him constantly. Now, an eternal love has been put into us, and an eternal love is coming towards us all the time, drawing us into itself. To receive the return of the seeds of the eternal love cast into man, and to give him new and eternal love. In fact, I wanted to be inside of man as a seed and outside of him as a worker. So he wants to be farmer on the outside and seed on the inside. It's all God's work. Okay, that's Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. So notice he wants to be the doer all the time. And you'll see that in all the early volumes that Jesus was saying to Louisa, let me do this. I know what I'm doing. I know what needs to be done. What you need to do is surrender to my action. Okay. So I wanted to be inside of man as a seed and outside of him as a worker in order to form in him the tree of my eternal love. Now, at the top of the page, what I've written for myself is the tree of life is the tree of eternal love. The tree of life is the tree of eternal love. And the tree of life is also the cross, Calvary. Okay? And we see on Calvary what eternal love actually looks like. That the person who loves would pay any price to save people who don't deserve it. Okay. So the tree of life, and we're going to get more of these messages as well, because Jesus himself is the tree of life. And so he makes us like him. So the love that's put into us is a tree of eternal love. Okay. So he wants to produce in us a tree of eternal love. Now, God is love, 1 John 4:7-17. What would be the good of man to have eyes filled with light if he did not have external light to illuminate them? Now, that's Psalm 36:9. Lord, in your light, we see light. If there was no light at all in this room, the fact that you have eyes wouldn't help, would it? No, because you actually need light in order to be able to see. And all the saints all down the centuries have told us that when we are in prayer and we're trying to receive from the Lord, they call it enlightenment. That means I receive more light, I understand more, I can go more towards God. And calling it enlightenment is correct. I receive more light. Okay. So he would remain in the dark if he didn't have external light. So in order to enjoy the effect of the light, it takes an internal light of the eye as well as an external light of the sun to illuminate. Isn't that fascinating? Okay. So he's talking about he has put a seed of eternal love into us. He is the eternal love coming towards us. And if we don't have his love, the little seed in us has nothing to actually go towards or love. It's the same for the mind. If man had no speech to express his thought, the life of his intelligence would die. Isn't that interesting? And would be without fruit, and so with all the rest. So Jesus continues, I loved man so much that I not only cast into him the seed of my eternal love, but I put him under the waves of my eternal love. Now, think of somebody in the sea. And if you're under the waves of the sea, you're under this immense thing coming towards you, because his love is eternal, absolute, infinite and immeasurable and all the rest of it. I put him under the waves of my eternal love. And when you're doing the hours of the Passion, particularly the closer you get to the actual crucifixion itself, you hear Louisa saying the ocean of love that's expressing itself through him. And that the greater the challenge, the higher his love goes to reach the challenge. And it's a fascinating, someday I'll put it on paper for you. It's a fascinating challenge. It's like somebody running in a hurdle race. And because the person is doing well, they raise the hurdle. And the person raised is their game. And then the hurdle is raised and the person raises their game and so on, until what actually happened in Jesus' dying was the ultimate of human experience, the ultimate of human endurance, the ultimate in human patience, the ultimate in human love, and you can go on and on, was actually reached. And this is why in the end, both John's gospel specifically or particularly says that in the last hour there was silence. They could not believe what they were looking at, that no matter what you did to him, there was going to be no darkness, no negativity, no reaction, no nothing. His love was higher than anything you could throw at him. So in a much smaller game, that's what life does to us as well. That when you pass the first test, then he tries you to see, will you take a bigger one? Then he tries to see, will you take a bigger one? Because some people, you know, don't want PhDs. You know, they say, well, I passed, you know. And I've heard Catholics say, oh, but if I get into heaven by the skin of my teeth. And then they stopped saying that to me because I told them to stop insulting God. I said, getting into heaven by the skin of your teeth is no glory to God. And it's certainly no glory to you either. Because it means you're too damn lazy to try. You won't make any effort. You won't let him bring you further. You won't let him challenge you. You know. So they stop when you react like that. You're not reacting nicely, you see. You're not being all religious with them. Sometimes they need just a real dose of reality. And the Lord has put this love inside of us. He has put these waves of love around us. And he tells us, I have to tell you now, it's in volume 7. I have to tell you this. He says, every single thing that happens to you, good, bad or indifferent, you are to take as a speciality of his love. Look at my garden. It's a speciality of his love. So it means that there's a hurdle you have to jump. Now do you get it? And if you only look at it in a human way and a worldly way, you're not even going to see the hurdle. You're not going to know that there is something to jump. And the thing is, if you can't jump it, ask him to lift you. You can always cheat, you know. You can say, Lord, I'm not able to jump that, but you could lift me, and then we'll pretend that I did it by myself. So there is this challenge, and you can see with Louisa all the time that she's being challenged more and more and more as well. And it's to see how far you will go in reaching out for life and in reaching out for love and in reaching out for the ultimate, in what I call reaching for the skies, okay? So I love man so much that I not only cast into him the seed of my eternal love, but I put him under the waves of my eternal love, which is spread throughout the whole of creation. So it doesn't matter where you go on earth, it doesn't matter what people you meet, it doesn't matter what circumstances you meet, this same mystery is happening. Okay? So it's spread throughout the whole of creation in order to make it germinate in him and to overwhelm him completely with my eternal love. Now, Jesus actually says that, I think, when he's being crowned with thorns. I want to overwhelm them with my love. So, if the light of the sun shines in his eyes, that's number one, it brings him a wave of my love. Number two, if he takes water to quench his thirst. Number three, food to nourish himself. They bring him the wave of my eternal love. Number four, if the earth lays itself under his feet and remains firm to allow his step, it brings him the wave of my love. Number five and six, the flower gives off its fragrance. If the fire unleashes its heat, everything brings my eternal love. So that's why I wanted to remind you of volume 7, because it's actually very like what it says there, except that he uses the words that everything that happens to you is a speciality of my love. It's the speciality bit I underlined for myself. But this isn't enough, he said. I myself am with them. That's called Emmanuel, God with us. Emmanuel. Matthew 28:20, I will be with you on all the days that are coming, even to the very end. I'm working inside and outside. That's Ephesians 2:10 and Philippians 1:6. The Lord will finish the job if you actually allow him. I'm working inside and outside. What am I doing? I want to arrange, to confirm and to seal all my similes in the soul of man so that as I give him eternal love he may also give to me. Because if love doesn't have its return, unrequited love is the greatest pain. So the creature also can love me with eternal love, only on the divine level, of course, because he contains this seed. But to my highest sorrow, man suffocates this seed, that is, with his selfishness. Man, of course, meaning all of us. And then it happens that even though my love keeps him under its waves, he does not feel the light which my love sends him, because having suffocated the seed, he becomes blind. And even though he burns, he does not get warm. And as much as he may drink and eat, his thirst is not quenched and he's not nourished. Where there's no seed, there's no fecundity. Isn't that interesting? So I love it when he shows you the opposite as well, because then you clear it. I mean, as a teacher, I always found it very important to tell the students what a thing was not and then tell them what it is. But once they had a comparison, they were okay, you know. So July the 1st, 1923, this is Prayer in the Divine Will, VIP. I was fusing myself in the Holy Divine Will in order to go around through each person's intelligence and to give to my Jesus the return of love for each thought of each person. But while I was doing this, a thought came to me, what's the good of praying in this way? On the contrary, it seems to me that this is nonsense rather than prayer. Now, I could bet a little bit of money on it that that thought didn't come to Louisa by herself. This is most likely the questions that the priests are asking her when they look at these texts, and they're asking her to ask questions. Louisa doesn't need this information. This information is for us. Is that okay? My always lovable Jesus moved in my interior. That's Luke 17:21. The kingdom of God is within you. And 1 Corinthians 3:16, know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you. So he moved in my interior and he told me, my daughter, do you want to know what the good and the effect of this is, of what she's just been talking about? That's entering into the divine will, going through the intelligence of everybody and giving God the return of love for them. He said, my daughter, okay. When the soul, I don't use the word creature very often because you're talking about souls or human beings or people, okay? So when the soul comes to cast the little stone of her will into the immense sea of my divinity, that's a lovely way of talking about fusing, isn't it? As she casts it, if her will wants to love, the infinite sea of the waters of my love ripple are agitated, and I feel the waves of my love giving off their celestial fragrance. And I feel the pleasure and the joys of my love being agitated by the little stone of the will of the creature. If she adores my sanctity, the little stone of the human will agitates the sea of my sanctity, and I feel cheered by the most pure auras of my sanctity. In sum, whatever the human will wants to do in mine, it flings itself like a little stone into each sea of my attributes. I mean, that's absolutely beautiful. And as it agitates them and ripples them, I feel as if I'm given my own things and the honours and the glory and the love which the creature can give me in a divine manner. It's the divine manner that we're talking about, okay? You can only do this when you fuse. And then he said, it's like a person it's like a very rich person who has the goods in his house. He has most fresh founts, fragrant founts, warm founts. Now, the image is from the ancient world, where only the rich would have a wonderful fount of water in their own property. Everybody else was carrying buckets of water on their heads from the local river or whatever. Someone else enters into this house and has nothing to give that person because he possesses everything. Because in the ancient world, if you had a fount of water in your own property, you had everything. Okay. However, he wants to please him. He wants to love him. And what does he do? He takes a little stone and casts it into the fresh fount. The water is being agitated, give off a most delicate freshness. And the lord of that house enjoys the pleasure and freshness of his own fount. Okay. He delights in the very goods that he possesses. But why? Because the other one took the care of agitating that fount, since when things are stirred, they give off their fragrance, the freshness or the heat that they contain intensely. This is what it means to enter into my will, to stir, to move my being. That I think you need to colour, to actually move the divine being. Okay. Now, what for myself, what I do is I put VIP beside the move the divine being. And you say to me, do you see how good and lovable and loving and holy and immense and powerful you are? You are everything, and I want to move the whole of you in order to love you and to give you pleasure. And you think that's trivial, he said, that a tiny creature. If you know how small the earth is, and you'll have some idea of the immensity of what's just been said. Because I've said this to you before, that if you take a model of the universe and go looking for the Milky Way, you'll see this. You can actually get this on the internet, but don't ask me how you get it. I find these things accidentally. You get a model of the universe, and it's actually not round. It's elliptical shape. And there's a reason for that. And if you go looking for the Milky Way, it's one pixel. It's all it is on the map of the universe. If that's the size of the Milky Way with all its trillions of stars, then what we're saying here is immense. Okay, so if you home in on this one pixel, and therefore you multiply it millions of times so you can see the Milky Way, go looking for the solar system and you find the pixel. That's a speck of a speck in the universe. Okay, and when you manage to home in onto the solar system, you find Earth is one of the smallest of the rocks. So we're a speck of a speck of a speck in the universe. And we're so big that you nearly have to be at tree level before you see us. And yet we're the most arrogant, proud race that ever could exist. Now, for someone, a tiny little creature on this tiny little rock, which is only a speck of a speck of a speck in the universe, to be able to move the divine being, that is unbelievable. Okay? And to let you know how unbelievable it is, I'm going to give you Psalm 8:5. Yet you made us little less than a god. With glory and honour you crowned us, giving us power over the works of your hands. But immediately before that, the psalm says, Lord, what is man that you'd even think of him? We're nothing. So you can see that with this reality in our minds, that the nothingness is the only thing that you can present to the allness. Quite literally, because if we think we're anything in that incredible scene, we're awfully foolish. And you see how stupid it is to see politicians and various people strutting and fretting their hour upon the stage, as Shakespeare said, and then they're heard no more. You know what I mean? I just look at them and I thought, they have no idea how silly they are. And they've no idea that the whole of heaven is looking on, you know? So it's amazing. So now in the next paragraph, we're going to be told something absolutely incredible, and you need to put a VIP even on the paragraph itself. And that is, each truth that Jesus reveals to us is a whole new creation that he makes. Because God's word is creative. If he expresses something, it comes into being. That's the way it is. So having said this, Jesus withdrew in my interior, and I was left thinking how good Jesus is. It seems to me that he greatly delights in communicating himself to us poor creatures, and that he takes so much pleasure in manifesting his truths that while he is saying one, that very truth is a spur for him and almost pushes him with an irresistible force to manifest more truths. What goodness, what love, Louisa said. And Jesus came out again from my interior. That's your Luke 17:21 again, to make sure you keep on reminding yourself that the kingdom of God is within. He came from out from within my interior and placed his face close to mine, saying, "My daughter, you do not know what it means to manifest my truths." We would say, you don't realize what I'm saying. And this is why you marvel at the pleasure and at the irresistible force that I feel to manifest myself to a human creature. And one who is willing to listen to me forms my joy. Now, all over the Old Testament, you have, very particularly through the prophets, it's Isaiah, it's Jeremiah, it's Amos, it's the lot of them. So I'm not going to give you one reference. I'd have to give them all. He says, "I only ever asked you to listen to me." Now, those of you who have reared children, haven't you said it over and over again? For God's sake, will you just listen? And what does the human being not do? Won't listen. Because if you don't listen, you don't receive the word. It's the same thing with us at Mass as well. The word is proclaimed, but if we don't listen, we don't hear it. And listening is not in the ear, it's in the heart. And one who's willing to listen to me forms my joy and my delights in conversing with her. Because listening means you're going to receive it in your heart. You must know that when I manifest one truth of mine, which is not yet known, it is a new creation that I make. You see, in this divine will revelation that the Lord is making to Louisa, he was creating a whole new era for the human race. It's a new creation that I make, and I love very much to release from myself the many goods and secrets that I contain. But as much as I may speak, since I am that act ever new, which never repeats itself. Look at that. Now, again, there's a summary of the Old Testament. No matter how often the people of God broke the covenant, he never patched it up. Never. He would give them something new, something new. He'd give them a new dispensation. He'd give them new rules. He'd give them new whatever. He doesn't patch. And you remember Jesus said that he wouldn't make Christianity a patch on Judaism. Do you remember? And he doesn't put new wine into old wineskins. He's ever new. Okay. Remember St. Augustine in the 4th century? "O beauty so ancient and so new, late have I loved thee." Okay. So he said, "I always desire to say more. And as I speak, I have always more things which I would like to say." That's illustrated very well in Genesis chapter 1. When he said, "Let there be light," then he got all excited about it and decided he wanted this, that and the other and all. Then he kept on speaking things into being. In fact, the Hebrew verb that is used for to create in the first line of the book of Genesis is bara, B-A-R-A, if it's in phonetics, okay, bara. And it means to speak something into existence from nothing in a divine manner. That's a long statement for one little four-letter word, bara. It's to speak something into existence in a divine manner. The other way you'd say it is to declare something into existence. For example, the third sentence of Genesis chapter 1 is Vayomer Elohim vehi or et vehi or. You heard me repeat something, didn't you? Mm-hmm. So, Vayomer, and God said, "Let there be light." Et vehi or. And there was light. So, it's spoken into existence. That's actually what they're telling you. And so, Genesis chapter 1 is actually a great help to understanding this. He speaks things into existence. If the Lord speaks to you, in prayer and says, forgive. He gives you the power to forgive. It's not a command as in do this or else. It's not that. He actually enables you to do it. It's terribly important for us to understand things like that. So I always desire to say more, he said. And as I speak, I've always more new things which I would like to say, because that newness is never exhausted in me. I am always new in love, new in beauty, new in contentment, new in harmonies, new in everything and ever new. If you remember in the hours of the Passion, the moment when Judas kissed Jesus on the face, do you remember? Louisa said that Jesus gave him new love. He gave Judas a love he had never given before to try and see if he could conquer this soul. It's very interesting, new love. But if we know that it's always new, then it means you can always go back to him and start all over again. It's terribly important for us to start all over again. Terribly important. Say, Lord, okay, I missed again. Can we start again? And he says, no problem. I'm new life. I'm new love. Everything with him is new. It's the most wonderful thing if you just get this, what he's saying. This is why he said, I do not tire anyone. Because we don't get tired if something is new. I've always new things to say and new things to give. And the irresistible force that pushes me to manifest myself is my love. So love is always wanting to give. It is an outpouring of love that I had when I issued creation. This is terribly important because, again, you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and you're hearing, let this come into being, and that, and everything is absolutely beautiful, and everything's in harmony, and everything balances everything else, and everything has its own place, and everything. And he's delighting in bringing everything into being. It's really fantastic. But he takes the same delight in bringing all the spiritual realities into being in us. He takes, well, I shouldn't say the same delight, it's probably infinitely greater, because it's a greater miracle getting any cooperation from us. So he said, it's always an outpouring of love when I issued creation. Everything that can be seen in the whole universe was all inside of me. Love made the shadow of my light overflow from my interior. Notice the shadow, because the whole of creation can only be the tiniest, tiniest shadow of the reality. But he tells us that if we would only contemplate creation, we would find him. And I created the sun, the shadow of my immensity and of my harmonies. And I extended the heavens, harmonizing them with many stars and celestial spheres. These and other things which I created were nothing other than shadows of mine, which I released from myself. And my love had its outpouring. And I took great delight in seeing what was contained inside of me, spread out in little particles hovering all over creation. Isn't that very interesting? So he's saying that everything in creation is a manifestation of his love. So you will understand, therefore, why he's saying to us that he wants us to put our I love you on everything as well, so that he gets a return of love. So in the next paragraph, he's going to contrast the difference between substance and reality. Substance and not just shadows. Now, what will be my joy in manifesting my truths, which are not shadows of mine which come out of me, but the substance of the goods I contain within me? These are the spiritual realities that he's actually revealing in this divine will material. He's revealing the essence of himself. The divine will is the essence, as he calls it, the operating part of the Trinity. So he's revealing things about himself that have never been known before. You have to go through most of the Old Testament before you will hit on anything that really says there's three persons in God. They kind of got a hint of it. They got a shadow of it, but they didn't really get the full thing. And so the full thing comes with Jesus in the New Testament. And now what he's doing is revealing as much as we can take who he really is. That tells you, of course, we've moved on towards the end times. Here now, it's the substance of the goods that contain in me, which speak of me, not in a mute language, like all created things. That's Psalm 19, verses 1 to 6, that all creation speaks in a mute language about the glory of God. But now here, I speak with clear, sonorous and eloquent voice, and which, since my word is creative, like a new creation, I create in the soul the truths that I manifest. Now, you often hear Louisa saying, after she has received a new revelation from the Lord, that she's completely stunned by this and she's completely taken up in it. And for days he won't speak again. And the reason is that she has to absorb it. She has to adjust to this completely new revelation, and she's to try and express it for us as well. It can take her days to do that. If with one fiat I created many things, in manifesting my truths, it's not just one fiat that I pronounce, but as many words, for as many are needed in order to manifest and to have souls understand that which I want them to understand. In other words, there's no point in him revealing things about himself as the divine will if we have no understanding. I don't know if you've ever gone to a lecture in which the lecturer was going on and on and on and you hadn't a clue. Now, that I had that experience in the university with a biochemistry class, and I thought he could be double Dutch to me. Doesn't matter what he writes on the board, it doesn't mean anything. I just didn't get it, and that was it. So knowledge without understanding is useless. And so what he says is that we must actually understand. So I want to give you Hosea 4:6. Without knowledge and understanding, the people perish. That's Hosea 4:6. And Luke 11:52. Understanding is important. And there's a very lovely moment, and it's in the Gospel of St. Mark. My mind is telling me chapter 7, but don't trust my mind. I'll give you the context and you'll recognize it. Jesus had worked the miracle of the loaves, and he was taking the apostles on a boat trip to the other side of the lake, and they had no food. And they were all worried about the fact that they had no food. And he's only worked a miracle for 5,000 people. And he turns to him and he said, "But didn't you get it? Didn't you understand how many people were there? 5,000. Was there enough food for them?" "Yeah, there was." "Who provided it? Did it occur to them to say, 'Give us a bit of bread in the boat?'" "No." He said, "Do you not understand?" You see, the knowledge without understanding is useless. Yeah. Absolutely useless. And because they had understood so little, they didn't manage very well when it came to the Passion. It was only when the Holy Spirit came to them afterwards in giving them wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge. That was when things began to come together for them. So he has to speak to us in a way that, and give us the grace at the same time to grasp it. Now, I'm sure you've had the experience of reading something in Louisa and you didn't get it. Yeah, have you been there?
Yes.
Okay, that's all right. You just keep going. Because at that moment, your soul wasn't open to the understanding. But if you go back and read it at another point, maybe at a more prayerful moment, you'll get it. There's nothing wrong with your intellect. It's that for the soul to grasp something, sometimes you have to go deeper in prayer so that the Holy Spirit with the knowledge and understanding, the two can come together and you say, "Oh yeah, that's what it means." So, I want them to understand. You need to put a VIP beside that. This is one of the reasons why we have classes and we try to explain the thing. That doesn't mean I understand everything. God help us. Imagine then, he said, what my contentment is in manifesting my truths to the soul, who, not in mute language, but with a speaking voice, will manifest my goods and my truths to others. Now, those of you who are teaching, put a VIP beside that, will you? He said, try and imagine my contentment when someone with a speaking voice will manifest my goods and my truths to others. This is why we're encouraging people to share with others. So I want to give you Psalm 119, verse 130. I want to give you Proverbs 2:4 and Proverbs 4:5. And then you can put etc. because there's so many references to it. Okay. So why does she manifest my goods and my truths to others? It's in order to infuse into them the good that she has received. Now, those of you who are already running classes know that you can only pass on to somebody else what you've grasped. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So when I started teaching Divine Will First, I was a newcomer myself. And so as a complete newcomer, I had a class. Could you imagine? And so when we would get to something, we were all at the same stage. And I'd say, anybody got any ideas? No, none of us had any ideas. We'll revisit that some other time. We'd move on. And you got it. You got it eventually. You'd go back and you say, ah, that's what he was saying. But the best thing to do was just simply to move on, you know. But you also find if you're teaching a class that in trying to explain it to somebody else, you'll get an insight. Isn't that right? Yeah, that's usually what the Lord does. And so the teacher can get something they've not got from anybody else. Because at that moment, the Lord wants everybody in your class to get the thing, so he'll give it to you. It's not because you're any better, it's that you're willing to share it. This is one of the reasons why I'm encouraging everybody to get a small little group and start sharing from the beginning. Okay, we'll be telling you much more about that in September. Therefore, in manifesting my truths, my love finds its outpouring and becomes festive. And I greatly love one who is willing to listen to me. Put a VIP beside that. I greatly love someone who is willing to listen to me. So that is when we are willing to take this on board and give him a chance to create a prodigy inside of us. Okay. So July the 5th, 1923. Louisa is looking at the moment when Jesus was presented to Pilate. So this is John 19. I was accompanying my suffering Jesus in the hours of his most bitter passion, especially when Jesus was presented to Pilate by the Jews and was accused. And Pilate, not satisfied with the simple accusations that they were making against him, returned to question him in order to find a reason sufficient to condemn him or to release him. And Jesus, beginning to speak in my interior, there's your Luke 17:21 again, told me, my daughter, everything in my life is profound mystery. Now, what I underline is profound. In other words, we all know the Gospels. We've all heard a certain level of explanation of the Gospels. And when everybody's finished explaining the Gospels with all the insights they ever have, we haven't touched the surface because it's all profound mystery. It's all sublime teachings is what Jesus is saying. Now, most of the time, we don't hear sublime teachings. We hear very trivial teachings because people are not praying enough and they're not searching enough to actually go into any kind of depth. Everything in my life is profound mystery and sublime teachings in which man must reflect himself in order to imitate me. Jesus is the only model. You must know that the pride of the Jews was so great. Now, the Jews is the Jewish leaders. Okay, the words are used in exactly the same way here as is used in the Gospels. It always means the leaders. It was so great. Now that's Matthew 5:20 and Matthew 6 verses 1 to 4. Especially in the false sanctity that they professed. That's your Matthew 6, 1 to 4. In other words, they had the right clothes. They had the right job. they were in the right place. They were saying the right things, but they were not living that way. Now we have the problem, that same problem in the church today. Not with everyone, thank God. Because of which they were held as upright and conscientious men. So that's why you get Matthew 6, 1 to 4. Don't pray like them, don't fast like them, and don't do anything like them, because they're looking for all kinds of stuff on the outside. So they looked as if they were upright and conscientious men, that they believed that by just presenting me themselves, this is very, very interesting. They believed their own lies, you see. That by saying that they had found me at fault and guilty to death, that Pilate would have to believe them and condemn me without making them undergo any interrogation. It's very, very interesting. These men, because they were in their jobs so long, dressed in their wonderful robes for so long and carrying out all these rites for so long, believed their own lie that because I'm dressed as a minister of God, that I am that person. But of course, in the church, we learned rather early that the habit doesn't make the monk. That's one of the very early sayings of the saints. The habit doesn't make the monk. And these men presumed that if they arrived in their wonderful robes in the presence of Pilate, who was a pagan and a leader in the politics out there, that Pilate should take their word for it. It's amazing. And one of the shocks in the whole passion of Jesus, which I actually love, is that Pilate let them know that not only did he not believe anything out of their mouths, that he absolutely despised them. And he could read them, and he could read their wrong motivation and everything. That doesn't make him any good either, but they could see it. So Jesus stood in the middle, and there was a battle going on between Pilate and the priests. And Jesus was the pawn. So it's amazing when you see it that way. So, more so, since they were dealing with a Gentile judge whom they despised, you see, who had no knowledge of God nor a conscience. I think that's rather interesting coming from Jesus, saying that Pilate had no conscience. Do you find that interesting? Yeah. But God disposed things differently in order to confound them, and to teach superiors. Now, superiors means anybody over anybody else, whether it's a pope, a cardinal, a bishop, a priest, a religious superior, a teacher, anybody. To teach superiors that as good and holy as the people who charge, sorry now, to teach superiors that as good and holy as the people who charge a poor accused one may appear. They should not believe them easily, but they should almost overwhelm them with many interrogations to see if there is any truth, and that under the appearance of goodness, that there's not some jealousy or rancor or the intention to snatch some aspired position or dignity from their superiors by making their way into their hearts. And they're rather interesting. Jesus absolutely insists that if somebody accuses somebody else, that that person should go under incredible scrutiny. What happens in the courts? The opposite. It's the victim that's scrutinized all the time. And many people, many women, for example, who have gone to court saying that someone has raped them, they feel raped a second time in court because they are treated as guilty until proven innocent, and the law should be the other way around. Yeah. Scrutiny makes one know people, Jesus said, and it confounds them, and it shows that one does not trust them. And you see, it would prevent also people in power from misusing people who are not in power. And in seeing themselves not appreciated, they dismiss the thought of aspiring to positions or of accusing others. Yet it would be a good cure if you got a good dressing down in court. Do you know what I mean? How much harm superiors do when keeping their eyes closed, trusting in false goodness and not in proven virtue. Look at that. They assign a position or they pay heed to someone who is accusing someone else of some fault. How humiliated the Jews, that's the Jewish leaders, were left in not being easily believed by Pilate. Of course, that only made them even more angry with Pilate, and they forced Pilate to kill Jesus in the end. In going through many interrogations, and if he surrendered to condemning me, it was not because he believed them. And that is perfectly clear in John 18 from verse 28 to John 19, 16. That's where this dialogue is coming out of. It's perfectly clear. Pilate didn't believe them. And it was pure revenge and anger that made them force Pilate. That's John 18, 28. John 18, 28. And it goes on to 19, 16. So he did not believe them, but because he was forced to, so as not to lose his position. Now look at this very clear explanation of the passion, because it's extremely clear in John 18 to 19 there that in the end, Pilate knew something very clear, that somebody was going to lose. It was either Jesus or himself. So he decided it's not going to be me. So that's why Jesus says here he was a man without conscience, you know. And the strange thing is Pilate did lose. Everybody in the trial of Jesus lost. Everybody. Jesus lost his life that day. Pilate lost his job when Caesar heard that he had condemned an innocent man. All the priests lost not only their jobs but their lives when the Romans came in AD 70 and they killed many priests on the altar before they desecrate, as part of their desecration of the temple. And then the temple was destroyed and then the city was destroyed. So they all lost. So it was a situation that, you know, looking at it from a purely human point of view, you'd say this was the craziest thing they ever did. This confounded them, that's the Jewish leaders, so much that in their extreme confusion and profound humiliation, they remained impressed on their foreheads like a mark. They never got over it. More so since they noticed more rectitude and more conscience in a Gentile judge than in themselves. At least Pilate wanted to examine the thing. At least Pilate said, now listen here, this man is not a criminal. And three times he proclaimed Jesus innocent. How necessary and just scrutiny is, Jesus says. It casts light and calm into the truly good people and confusion into those who are evil. I find that very interesting. So, and when wanting to scrutinize me also, Pilate asked, are you a king? Where is your kingdom? I wanted to give another sublime lesson by saying, I am king. And I wanted to say, but do you know what my kingdom is? My kingdom is my pains, my blood, my virtues. Now, he lost Pilate anyway, but he would have lost him a million times with that kind of an answer, okay? This is the true kingdom that I possess, not outside of myself, but within me, Luke 17, 21. Now, what Jesus is saying there is, you have a kingdom. That kingdom is within you, okay? And you are the Lord of that kingdom if you actually are in control of the passions and the desires and the ambitions and the this and the that and the other, okay? It becomes the kingdom of God when you hand that over to Jesus, the true king. Okay, and the kingdom of God is able to be established in us. Don't know if I'm making sense, am I? In charismatic prayer groups, they sing, reign in me, sovereign Lord, reign in me. Well, it's in the divine will you actually learn how to do that in its fullness. Okay, and that's when the true conquering has taken place. And so Jesus said, my kingdom is my pains, my blood and my virtues. What he's saying there is that he conquers his kingdom in all of us through his pains, his blood and his virtues. This is the true kingdom that I possess, not outside of me, but within. What one possesses on the outside is not a true kingdom, nor a safe kingdom, naturally enough, because as soon as you become the top person in politics, everybody else is looking for the job. Isn't that it? And one kingdom knocks out another kingdom in order for them to take over and so on. So it's not safe, because that which is not inside a man can be taken away, it can be usurped, and it can be he can be forced to leave it. But that which is inside, nobody will be able to take away from him. Its dominion will be eternal within him. Isn't that wonderful? The characteristics of my kingdom are my wounds, my thorns, and my cross. Therefore, I have to say to you that for the characteristics of his kingdom to be manifested in us, it's in thorns and wounds and cross. Okay. I know we prefer carpets and flowers and stuff, you know. I do not act like other kings who make their people live outside of themselves, unsafe and eventually even starving. Not me. I call my people to dwell inside the rooms of my wounds. John 14, verses 1 to 2. My Father's house, there are many rooms and there's one for you. Fortified and sheltered by my pains, their thirst quenched by my blood, their hunger satisfied by my flesh. This alone is true reigning. That's Romans 5:17, to reign in life with Christ. It's 1 Corinthians 4:8 and 2 Timothy 2:12. This alone is true reigning. All other reigns are reigns of slavery, of dangers and of death, while in my reign there is true life. This true life is a life that goes into everlasting life. Okay. How many sublime teachings, how many profound mysteries are in my words? And that's why we have to study them more and more. Each soul should say to herself, in pains and in sufferings, in humiliations and in abandonments by all, and in practicing true virtues, this is my kingdom. Now that should be underlined in green, white and gold. I'm going to read it again. Each soul should say to herself, when she's experiencing pains and sufferings and humiliations and abandonments by all, and at the same time practicing true virtue, this is my kingdom. And it's not subject to perishing. No one can take this away from me. No one can even touch it. On the contrary, my kingdom is eternal and divine, similar to that of my sweet Jesus. My sufferings and pains certify it for me and render my kingdom more fortified and fierce in such a way that in the face of my great strength, no one will be able to war against me. Now, who's the one who wants to wage war against you? The demon. Okay. So this is the kingdom of peace to which all my children aspire. Okay. So let's give you something about peace. Psalm 9:6, Jesus is the King of Peace. Isaiah 9:6. See, I'm looking at another reference there. Isaiah 9:6. Isaiah 26:3. Isaiah 26:3 says, you keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you. I want to give you Psalm 4:8, 29:11, and 34:14. I want to give you Luke 2:14. John 14:27 and Colossians 3:15. That's a lot, but it's not everything. There's an awful lot more as well. Just to let you know that, you know, when you come to the New Testament, you'll find peace is spoken about in all the letters, you know. So July the 11th, 1923, we're talking about the new era. Because in revealing the divine will, Jesus is unleashing a new era of grace and glory. Okay. Louisa said, I was praying and abandoning all of myself in the arms of my most sweet Jesus, and with a thought in my mind that was saying, only for you, this martyrdom of having to bother others. of being a burden to your ministers. Now, the thing, the thorn in her side is the priest coming every day. Okay. As I cannot do without letting them meddle in my business. Look at the way she is dealing with it. I think it's brilliant. These priests are supposed to be her spiritual directors. They are her connection with the bishop. But the lovely thing about Louisa is she tells it as she experiences it. And she says, at the time, they're meddling in my business. I love that. So the thing that's lovely about her is she makes no attempt to be the pious person. She makes no attempt at saying it the way somebody expects me to say it. She tells you how she experiences. That's why I just love it, you know. She's just so true to herself.
Did they ever doubt her?
So she said, they meddle in my business, in the things that pass between me and Jesus. The others are free. They enter a state of suffering. The others are other victim souls. Louisa is presuming other victim souls are different, but usually victim souls have to have a priest looking after them because they need so much help. I mean, Padre Pio had to have a lot of help, you know, and in the end, his whole community revolved around him, you know. The others are free, she says, they enter into a state of suffering and they can free themselves by themselves. Yet how many times I prayed for him to free me, but in vain. Now, he has explained to her over and over again why this is happening, but she doesn't let it go. And what she's doing there is she's expressing us that if there's something really, as we would say in Ireland, killing us, we're not able to let it go. We complain and we moan and we complain and we moan. And that's what she's doing. And I love that because, again, she's telling us she's real. She's not pretending to be something she isn't. Now, while I was thinking of this and other things, she said, Blessed Jesus came, all goodness and love, and placing himself near me, he said, My daughter, the greater the work I want to do, the more necessary it is that the soul I choose be unique and singular. This is terribly important. Louisa probably still doesn't grasp how great is the revelation that the Lord is making through her. So what has just been said there applies absolutely to Blessed Mother with regard to redemption and to Louisa with regard to the divine will. So the work of redemption was the greatest, and I chose only one person, endowing her with all gifts never conceded to anybody else, so that this person might contain so much grace as to be able to become my mother, and so that I might deposit in her all the goods of redemption. And in order to keep my own gifts safe, from the moment she was conceived until she conceived me, I kept her hidden in the light of the Most Holy Trinity. Isn't that incredible? So all her life was quite literally hidden because she was with her parents until she was three. Then she was in the temple. Okay. So I kept her hidden in the light of the Most Holy Trinity, which was her custodian. And the Blessed Trinity had the office of directing her in everything. That's Deuteronomy 32:12. Deuteronomy 32:12. The Lord alone was her guide. Then, when I was conceived in her virginal womb, being the true priest and the head and the first of all priests, I myself took on the charge of keeping her and directing her in everything. So that's the hidden life in Nazareth, okay? Even in the motion of her heartbeat. And when I died, I entrusted to her another priest, which was Saint John. A soul so privileged, who contained all graces, unique in the divine mind, unique in history. I did not want to leave her without the assistance of a representative of mine up to her last breath. Of course, St. John was with her right up to her last breath. Have I perhaps done this to other souls? No. Because they did not contain so much good, so many gifts and graces, and therefore so much custody and assistance wasn't actually necessary. So now he comes to Louisa. And again, he's going to explain why the priest has to come. But this is at least his fourth time to have to explain it. "Now, my daughter, you too are unique in my mind. Why? She's the very first person who has been born with original sin to reach the divine will, to reach the level of the divine will. Now, because he has lifted her to this level, he opens the kingdom of the divine will and the rest of us can come later. Because Blessed Mother had the divine will from the first instant of her being, and she had the Immaculate Conception, then redemption could happen because of her, okay? And the rest of us can trot along and take as much of redemption as we want. That's the process that he's talking about. There will not be, either before or after you, another person for whom I will dispose, as though forced by necessity, the assistance of my ministers." Okay. "Having chosen you in order to deposit in you the sanctity, the goods and the effects and the attitude of my supreme will, it was appropriate, just and decorous," it says here, we would say right, "for the very sanctity that my will contains, that one of my ministers should assist you and be the first depository of the goods which my divine will contains." Now, we've already met the fact that two of her spiritual directors have already died, and that as much of the divine will that they had taken in, they benefited hugely in heaven. And of course, Hannibal is canonized as well. Hannibal de Francia. So that these priests should be the first depository of the goods which the divine will contains. In other words, the Lord wanted the official church to accept this message first, before anybody else, so as to let them pass from his lap into the whole body of the church. So it's supposed to go through the priests to the laity, but at the moment it's the other way around. "What great attention is required of you and of them. Of you in receiving from me, like a second mother." Now, in volume two, he asked her to be a second mother, if you want the reference there. "The great gift of my will, and in knowing all of its qualities, of the priests in receiving them from you, so that the fiat voluntas tua on earth as it is in heaven may be fulfilled in my church." So the priests have to realize they have to be involved if the Our Father is being fulfilled. That is part of their mission. And so they were to be completely involved in it from the very beginning. "I removed from..." wait a minute now. Oh, yeah. "You do not know how much I had to give you to dispose you to this capacity." In other words, the enormity of the prodigies of grace that had to be given to her to overcome her nature, her training that she would get through the priests, to overcome all the customs of the church and all the rest of it. "So that I might deposit my will in you." Watch this now. What he says now is absolutely incredible. "I removed from you any seed of corruption." That means he removed concupiscence. He never did that before or since. He didn't have to do it with Blessed Mother because she had the Immaculate Conception from the beginning. But from Louisa, she had to have the concupiscence removed from her so that she could live at the level of the divine will and be the receptor of this incredible thing. "I purified your soul. I purified your very nature in such a way that neither do you feel anything for them nor they for you." In other words, the passions are not demanding anything from you and you're not looking for anything from them. You're only looking to me. So concupiscence is gone. "Since the seed is missing," the seed is concupiscence, "it is as if the fire were missing, the firewood." So none of the ordinary temptations that we would go through, she was going through because concupiscence had been removed. "And even though I did not exempt you from original sin, as I did with my dear mother. By removing from you the seed of corruption, I worked another prodigy of grace never conceded to anybody else. Now, this particular section is absolutely unique. Make sure you put VIP on it and NB and everything else that you put on something, because this aspect will always have to be said about Louisa. Okay. And he says very clearly, I never conceded this to anybody else, because it was not right for my will, thrice holy, to descend into and take possession of a soul which would be shaded even slightly by the slightest corrupted breath. Now, he said that about his mother, that he could not have been born, conceived and born in her if there had been the slightest shade of sin. And he's saying to Louisa that because the whole of the divine will has to go into her, she has to be lifted that level as well. But the difference is that now one of us has been lifted to that level. And because the gift has been given to her, then the door is left open for the rest of us to receive as much as we can. But since the Lord hasn't removed concupiscence from us, I presume you understand we won't be sort of at the height that she's at. Is that okay? If I'm in the field at all, I'd be glad. Don't know about you, because this is incredible stuff, isn't it? So by removing from you the seed of corruption, I worked another prodigy of grace never conceded to anybody else, because it was not right for my will, thrice holy, to descend into and take possession of a soul that would be shaded even slightly by the slightest corrupted breath. My will would not have adapted itself to taking possession of her, to communicating its attitude to her, had it seen any seed of corruption. Okay. Isaiah 35:8. This is the seed of corruption. Revelation 21:27. Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. That's it. Finito. Okay. And Isaiah 35 describes the highway to heaven of the redeemed. And it says very specifically in verse 8, no unclean thing can be on this road. Of course, I could give you 1 John 3:2 as well, where John says that someone who is truly in union with God does not sin. There can't be sin in this person. And we know ourselves that to have any level of the divine will in us, there cannot be sin. It's as simple as that. That's why don't be slow at telling somebody they're not ready for divine will. I just say to them, look, it's just live the level you're at and do what you can to get ready, because sin has got to be eliminated to come into the divine will. And if it's said very clearly to them, they won't have the problem that they would have by coming into class and suddenly discovering that they can't continue. So Jesus said, just as I, the word of the Father, would not have adapted myself to being conceived in the womb of my celestial mother had I not exempted her from original sin. And then how many graces have I not given to you? You think it's nothing, he says to her, and therefore you think you give it no thought. When he says that to her, he's simply saying, you've accepted this without even thinking about it. And because it has happened to you and you've accepted it, you're not realizing it's the enormous prodigy that it actually is. And instead of thanking me, he says, you occupy yourself with thinking about what I've disposed for you and about those I have placed around you, while I want you to only follow my will. And she started obviously by saying that the priests were annoying her. He says, you've no idea what I'm actually trying to do. Would you get your eyes off trivialities and try and put them on the go? It's typical us, isn't it, that the Lord's trying to do something and then we distract ourselves with trivialities. So the next paragraph, you're now being introduced to the higher volumes, which the messages are much longer. Okay. You must know that this fulfillment of my will is so great, Jesus said, as to be numbered among the greatest works which the divinity has operated. Please put NB VIP or something on that, would you? What he's doing in the divine will is among the greatest of the things that God has thing. So God is trying to work with us little nothings to do this incredible thing, I think is marvellous. And so the only thing I say to him is I want to throw my nothingness into your allness at every second so that I don't block you at any moment, okay? And I wanted to be known, he said. There it is again. You've got to teach others. So that in knowing its greatness and the immense good that it contains, they, that is other souls, will love it, esteem it and desire it. Three times the supreme divinity decided to operate ad extra. That means on the outside of themselves. Number one, the first was in creation and it was without the intervention of any creature, since none of them had yet come to the light of day. The second time that the Blessed Trinity operated ad extra is in redemption, and with it intervened a woman, the holiest and the most beautiful, my celestial mother. She was the channel and the instrument I used in order to fulfill the work of redemption. Number three, the third is the fulfillment of my will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. In other words, the fulfillment of the Our Father. That is, for the soul to live and operate with the sanctity and the power of our will. Now, there you have it in a nutshell, what living in the divine will, that the soul would be able to operate with the sanctity and power of our will. A work which is inseparable from creation and redemption, just as the sacrosanct Trinity is inseparable. Nor can we say that the work of creation has been completed by us if our will, as we decreed, does not act in the soul and live with that freedom, sanctity and power with which it operates and lives in us. Now, you see, neither creation nor redemption is complete until the human being comes back to God and lets him have complete freedom with us. Then creation is complete and then redemption is complete as well. So all three of these fiats of God, they're all together as one. And he tells us as we go along, he loves doing everything in threes. Because that represents the three of them. Okay. Even more, this is the most beautiful point, the highest, the brightest, and the seal of the fulfillment of the work of creation and redemption. Now, this is it. This is the icing on the cake. These are divine decrees, Jesus said, and they must have their full completion. And in order to fulfill this decree, we want to use another woman, and that's you. The woman was the incitement, the cause for which man, the human race, fell into his misfortunes. And we want to use the woman to put things in order. Now, one of the things that's fascinating in reading the way the Lord works is the detail. If a woman brought the disaster, she used to tidy up. That means you say to the kids, you brought the disaster into this room, you put it back. And so you're teaching them order if you do that. Okay. And I think if we don't teach children order, we get disorderly adults. So the woman was the cause, so the woman had to be used to put things back in order. And we want to use woman to put things in order, to let man out of his misfortunes and to give back to him decorum, honour, our true likeness, just as he was created by us. So this is what you get at the very beginning of each one of your volumes, that the call is to return to the order and the place and the purpose for which we were created. That's what he's talking about here. Therefore, be attentive and don't take things lightly, he says. This is not just about anything. This is about divine decrees. Now, whatever about Louisa thinking that taking them lightly, the problem is that Monsignor taking it lightly. Because the Monsignor half the time doesn't really believe what's going on. These are about divine decrees and about giving us the field to let us accomplish the work of creation and redemption. Therefore, just as we entrusted our mother to Saint John, that she might deposit in him and from him to the church the treasures, the graces, and all my teachings which I had deposited in her during the course of my life, when she was entrusted to me and I acted as priest to her, as I deposited in her, as in a sanctuary, all the laws, precepts, and doctrines which the church was to possess. Here you have one of these impossible sentences again. Okay, let's go back. One of the reasons why John's gospel is much, much, much more rich than the others is that John was with Blessed Mother all by himself for years after the resurrection. And she taught him everything. And she taught him the deeper meanings of absolutely everything. You'll get this if you read Maria Valtorta. Okay. And it was John who was able to give the others the deeper meanings of things, because he was getting them from the source. Now, who taught them about the incarnation and Bethlehem and all the rest? She did. It's the obvious. Okay. But if you read Maria Valtorta, you'll find that Jesus told his apostles as well. But all the deeper teachings that were to go on to the church was given by Blessed Mother to John in those years. She lived approximately 16 years after the resurrection of Jesus. That was plenty of time to teach John personally. Okay. So Jesus says here that he deposited in his mother all the laws and precepts and doctrines of which the church was to possess. Now, the Protestants want to tell us that we made all this stuff up. Isn't that interesting? Whereas the church knew from the beginning. But not everything was written. And that's why we speak about tradition as well as the scriptures. And she, faithful as she was, and jealous of even one word of mine. Look at that. Now, one of the things that the Bible says of the prophet Samuel was that he never allowed a word of God to fall to the ground. Look at this. This is the same thing. Jealous of even one word of mine, deposited them in my faithful disciple, John. Now, when you go back to the prophet Isaiah, he was living through a difficult time as well, 100 years before the exile. And he deposited all his teachings in his disciples. Hence, when you read the book of Isaiah, it goes through about 200 years of history. So he said, Blessed Mother deposited them in my faithful disciple John, so that they might not be lost. And therefore, my mother has primacy over the whole church. So it was only the Second Vatican Council that declared her mother of the church. Wasn't that it? So I did with you, Jesus said. Since this fiat voluntas tua must serve the whole church, I entrusted you to a minister of mine, that you may deposit in him everything I manifested to you about my will, the goods contained in it, how the soul must enter into it, how the paternal goodness wants to open another era of grace, placing his goods, which he possesses in heaven, in common with the creatures on earth, and giving back to the soul her lost happiness. Therefore, be attentive. That's a massive piece. And I had to read it slightly quickly because the time is more than up. We've only one more tiny bit, but I'll leave it till next week. Is that okay? Sorry? Yeah. You don't want to finish it tonight, do you? Do you want to finish the last piece? Oh, that's all right. That's okay. It's just I thought I was pushing you. That's okay. We'll finish it then. So July the 14th, 1923 is the expectation of a new era. The surest sign that it is near. Okay. As I was in my usual state, my good Jesus came, but all afflicted. It seemed to me that he could not detach from me and was all goodness. With all goodness, he told me, my daughter, I have come to make you suffer, he said. Don't you remember that when I wanted to chastise the human race and you didn't want me to do it, wanting to suffer yourself in their place, and in order to make you content, I told you that instead of doing 10, for love of you, I would do 5. Now, this is Genesis 18, verses 16 to 32. You remember the intercession of Abraham for Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, in the early volumes of Louisa, Louisa's intercession managed to get one third of a response from the Lord. Now, 33% diminishment of a chastisement for one human being praying is unbelievable. But now he says he wants to give her 50%. Isn't that absolutely incredible? Absolutely incredible. Now the nations want to fight against one another, he said. And those who believe themselves to be the most powerful, they were the Western nations, are taking up arms to their teeth in order to destroy the weak nations. This is about total destruction. I saw just an advertisement about the Second World War on the television today. I was just flicking through something and I thought, they said this was about total destruction. It was not about conquering. That's exactly what Jesus says here. It's about total destruction. This is why I have come to make you suffer, he said, to give you that 50% that I promised you. My justice will give to fire and water the power of the office that they contain in order to destroy people and entire cities. Now, waters are, of course, the tsunamis, and there have been terrible fires around the place as well. And therefore, a little bit of your suffering is necessary in order to reduce the chastisements by half. Now, before I go on, I have to say something. That reads perfectly normal to you, doesn't it? But you have forgotten that from volume 7 up to volume 10, Louisa was complaining all the time, I have less sufferings. I'm not really suffering. Why don't you let me suffer? And he was guiding her away from just being a victim soul to this new, completely unique role of opening the kingdom of the divine will, you see. And then by the time you get to volume 13, she has settled down into this new thing. And here she is in volume 15, and he brings her back to it. But he had explained back there in volume 7, I think it is, that whether you suffer or don't suffer doesn't actually matter, because you're a victim soul anyway. Let me give you that as an example. If you're married, whether you're sick or well, you're still married. Whether you're at home at this moment or away from home at this moment, you're still married. That's the state you have. Is that okay? So he was saying to her, whether you suffer or not is not actually the issue. The issue is that you're a victim soul, and everything you experience is part of that. And she just hadn't had taken that into account. OK, so it's slightly unusual then for him to say this to her at this particular point. But she's totally ready, because she was like the batteries ever ready, you know. Now, while he was saying this, he moved in my interior. That's your Luke. What is it? 17:21. Some of them now you should get off by heart. As though holding many instruments in his hands. And as he moved them, sufferings and pains were formed with such tearing of all my members that I don't know how I remained alive. And when he would see me moaning and shivering because of the intensity of the pains, with the air of one who has triumphed over everything, he would say to me, you are my life. And with my life, I can do whatever I want. Now, is he just glorying in her suffering? No, it's in seeing another Christ willing to pay this price to save his or her brothers and sisters. And he will, as we go on, he will actually take her to heaven, and he will boast to the angels and saints in heaven, nobody has loved him like this. It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? That's why he says, you are my life. And with my life, I can do whatever I want. And he would continue his crafting to make me suffer. May everything be for the glory of God. Then afterwards, he added, my daughter, the whole world is upside down. Gosh, a century later, how would you even say it? If it was upside down a century ago. And everyone is awaiting changes, peace and new things. They themselves gather to discuss about it, and they are surprised at not being able to conclude anything and to come to any serious decisions. So true peace does not arise. And everything resolves into words, but not deeds. And they hope, and they have more conferences, they hope that more conferences may serve to make serious decisions, but they wait in vain. Now, isn't that a rerun of what you've heard on the news for the past number of years? Mm. All they're doing is gathering. They have the G7, the G this, and they have the ministers of this, and they have the government of that, and all the governments coming together, and they're all talk, and they're all... There's nothing. They come to no conclusions. He said it's all in vain. In the meantime... it should put beside that John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. In the meantime, in this waiting, they are in fear, and some prepare themselves for new wars, some hope for new conquests. So notice there's not clear motivation there. Some wouldn't mind a war at all so they can make new conquests. But with this, the people are impoverished. They are stripped alive while they are waiting, tired of the sad present era, dark and broody, which enwraps them. They wait and hope for a new era of peace and light. And what Jesus is saying is that the world has actually shifted focus, that everybody desperately wants a new era. But the thing is, they want it on the wrong level. Okay. The world is exactly at the same point as when I was about to come on the earth. And that tells you it's time for the second coming. Okay. And when Jesus actually came the first time, it was to a corrupt priesthood in Israel. Now he would come to exactly the same situation. There's nothing new on the earth. Nothing at all. He said, all were waiting for a great event, a new era, as indeed occurred. It is the same now. Since the great event, the new era in which the will of God may be done on earth as it is in heaven, is coming. Underline that one. Everyone is awaiting this new era, tired of the present one. But without knowing what the new thing is, without knowing what the change is about, just as they didn't know it when I came upon the earth. This expectation is a sure sign that the hour is near. But the surest sign is that I am already manifesting what I want to do, and that turning to a soul, just as I turned to my mother in descending from heaven to the earth, I communicate to her my will and the goods and the effects that it contains. So everything is ready. Isn't that amazing? So that's the end of volume 15.